president signs a $740 billion bipartisan national defense budget, millions more for fighter jets, a space force, and new nuclear weapons.
It's now signed.
What does it mean for people of color? And a freight train derails in Harper's Ferry. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Saturday, December 21st, 2019. First of these headlines, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel on Saturday named Tourism Minister Manuel Marrero Cruz as the country's first prime minister since 1976, a nomination quickly confirmed by the country's parliament. The position of prime minister was held by Fidel Castro from 1959 to 1976, when a new constitution changed the title to president and eliminated the posts of prime minister. Marrero, 56, has been tourism minister for 16 years, presiding over a rise in visitors and hotel construction boom that has made tourism one of the most important sectors of the Cuban economy. Cuba welcomed 4.3 million tourists this year, fewer than hoped for, but more than double the 2 million who arrived the year Marrero Cruz was named tourism director. And authorities said they will begin the process to exonerate a Houston man convicted in a 2010 fatal stabbing investigators now believe was committed by someone else. Lydell Grant, 42, was freed on bond last month after a new analysis of DNA found on the victim's fingernails pointed to his innocence in the killing of 28-year-old Aaron Shearhorn. The Harris County District Attorney's Office said Friday that Grant had been eliminated as a suspect and another person had been arrested in Shearhorn's slaying. And in Washington, House Democrats asked for documents from federal prosecutors and Florida law enforcement officials on Friday as part of a probe into how financier Jeffrey Epstein received a secret deal, a plea deal, more than a decade ago. Epstein reached the deal in 2008 when then-Miami U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta's office moved to end the federal probe that could have landed him in prison for life. Epstein instead pleaded guilty to lesser state charges, spent 13 months in jail, paid financial settlements to victims, and registered as a sex offender. Acosta was appointed labor secretary by President Donald Trump, but he resigned in July amid renewed scrutiny of the secret plea deal. Epstein, 66, killed himself in his New York City jail cell in August after federal agents arrested him on new sex trafficking charges. And President Trump last night at Andrews Air Force, Joint Base Andrews, right, the Andrews Air Force Base of my youth, signed the annual defense policy bill Friday night, establishing his space force and giving federal workers 12 weeks of paid paternal leave at the same time.
This is a truly historic day for the American Armed Forces. In just a few minutes, I will proudly sign into law the largest ever investment in the United States military. In fact, I can say the largest ever by far. Today also marks another landmark achievement as we officially inaugurate the newest branch of our military. This is a very big and important moment. It's called the Space Force.
The bipartisan defense budget was passed by the Senate last week. Democrats were able to get the first parental leave bill for federal employees included in the spending measure. The compromise bill continues a pattern of large military expenditures by the United States far above any other country.
The law I'm signing today provides $738 billion. That's with a B. $738 billion in defense funding for the 2020. That's an all-time record in the history of our country. That's the highest amount we've ever spent on our military. And that's after $700 billion in my first year and $716 billion last year. And it's all made right here in the USA. It's very important.
Trump touted the appropriation's military spending goals.
In addition to massive acquisitions in the past 2 years, this bill authorizes nearly 100 new F-35s, 24 brand new FA-18s, 155 Army helicopters of all different types, 165 brand-new, beautiful Abrams tanks, said to be the best in the world, more than 50 Paladin howitzers, 2 new Virginia-class submarines, 3 new Arleigh Burke destroyers, a Ford-class aircraft carrier, and 2 others on their way, and much, much more. But as we discussed earlier, our military is getting far more than just new equipment. For this first time, and I have to say, you know what happened last year? It was a good pay raise, but now you're getting another pay raise, and this will be the largest pay raise in more than 10 years, more than a decade. So if you don't want it, you don't have to take it.
The NDA establishes the Space Force as the 6th branch of the U.S. military, with the goal of protecting U.S. assets in space from threats from Russia and China. The new service will be part of the Department of the Air Force in a structure similar to the Marine Corps relationship to the Navy, and will be led by a 4-star chief of space operations. At Friday's ceremony, Trump officially announced he would nominate General John Raymond to be the chief of space operations. Raymond is currently the commander of the U.S. Space Command.
With my signature today, you will witness the birth of the Space Force. And that will be now officially the 6th branch of the United States Armed Forces. That is something really incredible. It's a big moment. That's a big moment, and we're all here for it. Space. Going to be a lot of things happening in space. Because space is the world's newest warfighting domain. Amid grave threats to our national security, American superiority in space is absolutely vital. And we're leading, but we're not leading by enough, but very shortly we'll be leading by a lot. The Space Force will help us deter aggression and control the ultimate high ground. I particularly want to thank Vice President Mike Pence. He was so involved in this with me. This was the love that I think we can say, Mike, that we both had for this project, because we realized how important it is to our military, to our future, to our defense. So important. And it's going to blend in magnificently with everything else that we have. So I want to thank Mike Pence. Mike, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Great job, Mike. It was nearly half a century from Kitty Hawk to the creation of the Air Force, and now it's 50 years after Apollo 11 that we create the Space Force. With today's signing, I will proudly appoint General J. Raymond, the first Chief of Space Operations, and he will become the very first member of the Space Force, and he will be on the Joint Chiefs. He will be on the Joint Chiefs, which are now expanding by one position. That's a very powerful position. So, General Raymond, congratulations, and thank you for everything you've done.
Trump floated establishing a space force in 2018 and has since become a top priority and a reliable applause line at his rallies. But the idea for a separate military service for space originated as a bipartisan proposal in the House in 2017. How does the defense budget affect the public? Vincent Intondi is the professor of history he's a writer of the book, the author of the book African Americans Against the Bomb. He has this to say.
I was hoping following this, especially through the summer, that some of the things that the House was trying to get in would get in. Many of those things were scratched. Some were really fighting to try to stop the production of more low-yield nuclear weapons, and that's out, so we're going to have more of them. And you also have, there was a medal, they were trying to get medal and recognition for the atomic veterans who were tested on throughout the 50s. That got scrapped. They took $100 million out, reduction from the last NDAA for cleanup of radiation and nuclear waste. They put in there to have 80 new plutonium pit sites per year starting to be created in 2030. So there's just one thing after another. No New START has happened yet. So It's a dream for the nuclear lobby, for the military-industrial complex. We should just frighten everybody that we have Donald Trump with the sole authority to launch nuclear war. No first use is still not passed. So I don't see this as a win in any way for those trying to fight for nuclear disarmament.
The Democrats went along with it. It was bipartisan, the support for the bill. And in return, they got parental leave, I guess, for federal employees for the first time. Was that trade-off worth it?
Parental leave certainly is an incredibly important piece, and you'd like to see compromise in some way to start to work in government again. But at the same time, there's things that you have to take a certain stand on. And when it comes in terms of nuclear weapons, it doesn't matter if we have parental leave before all dead from nuclear war. You know, reading in the Washington Post this morning that literally 117 people just in D.C. are homeless, have died this year, and then finding out we're spending $1.2 trillion on nuclear weapons, our priorities are just a mess. And so I think Democrats were trying to say, do we give them some wins or stop a shutdown and try to do these things bipartisan while we're doing this impeachment? You also have to understand that even those that can be progressive Democrats look at their constituencies and where they're living. So for those where the main employer is, say, Lockheed Martin, it's to them not really even about nuclear weapons. It's a jobs program. And their fear is that if they cut any of this, then they're going to have to face angry constituents at home who might be facing unemployment. So that's another piece of this. And we already have enough nuclear weapons to end the world multiple times over. Why are we creating more? And so in many cases like that, it is just simply a jobs program, which is ridiculous, but that's the reality.
You mentioned that they were going to be building more of these plutonium pits. What are those and what's the problem with that?
So these plutonium pit sites are to build, to refurbish, to house more plutonium. The most notable one is at the former Savannah River, or the Savannah River site, and turning that into a plutonium pit site as housing this plutonium for more nuclear weapons. The problem is to do this in terms of everything from the possibility of accidents happening and the safeguards, but also the amount of money that is going to take to build these sites. The Obama administration was pushed to do this and cut it, scrap the plans, because it just wasn't effective in terms of how, if we're going to maintain a nuclear arsenal, this is not the best way to do it.
What is a pit? What is a plutonium pit?
It's where you're going to, how you're housing the actual plutonium. So, I mean, I don't want to get too scientific on you. For me, to look at the history of where they're making these sites, when you look at Hanford, when you look at, again, Savannah, with the amount of nuclear waste that has gotten out there, the amount of discrimination, quite frankly, that has happened, there's just better ways if we're looking at how we're going to produce and hold all of this plutonium. So never before, for example, has the Savannah River site produced this, done this. And so now you're going to take this mixed oxide fuel facility that they're trying to change it into, construct it. They're already trying to do cleanup in the past at Savannah River site. It's just a horrible recipe of trying to, where you're going to house this, again, all in an effort to maintain, build, and modernize nuclear weapons instead of going the other way and saying we need to get rid of them.
You've worked specifically on how nuclear weapons race affects people of color in America and around the world. How does that specifically, why should people of color in New York care about this issue, which has often been seen as a white guy's issue?
You are seeing, and this was another thing we tried to get in, is to address the issue of how nuclear weapons testing over the years has affected the non-white world. And that is, we're seeing more studies being done from everywhere, from the Marshall Islands into Native American communities. When we look specifically at the Black community, you have to look, A, at where money is being spent. Again, when we look at the Black community, whether it is schools, whether it is free school lunches, whether it is programs that could benefit the Black community, especially when we look at if nuclear weapons were being used in terms of populations and dense populations in cities, who would be affected? And also, again, when we connect things through colonialism in the non-white world, if we're looking at who possesses nuclear weapons in the world, where they're being threatened to be used, these things are all connected. And again, there's no glaring example that if you look at something like our policies where we're building more nuclear weapons, and then you look at the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, which is on the cusp of being ratified at the United Nations, where over 100 countries have joined together and the majority of them are non-white. there's no, you know, bigger example than of having, again, the people, the two that have the most nuclear weapons in the world right now are Putin and Trump, two authoritarian white nationalists. And on the other side, you have a majority of the non-white world saying, we reject these weapons, we don't want these weapons. Again, look who they've been used on and continue to be tested on or threatened on. It's usually people of color.
Vincent Intondi is a professor of history and author of African Americans Against the Bomb. Elaine Scarry is on the faculty of Harvard, a professor of aesthetics who deals with problems of nuclear weapons. She's the author of Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. She says there is hope if the public embraces disarmament.
It's terrifying, and I think it's morally reprehensible. These are weapons that, including nuclear weapons, that have the power to very quickly eliminate not just our own species, but every species on Earth. And we keep buying new weapons and trying to perfect them and update them. We already have over 6,000 nuclear weapons, many of which are on hair trigger alert. We are upgrading them over the next 30 years. At the same time that our own infrastructure, things that people of the United States need to survive, like roads and bridges and levees, are in deplorable condition. For example, the American Society of Civil Engineers in 2017 gave a grade of D or D minus to our levees, D to our highways, 1 out of every 5 miles has potholes, a C plus to our bridges. It enumerated the hundreds of thousands of bridges that are being crossed over every day in the United States, a very huge number of which need to be structurally repaired. And our public transit, they also give a D to. So while our infrastructure is getting demoted and degraded, we are continuing to build weapons. This is something that people in the United States need to talk to their representatives about and insist that they stop. You know, perhaps if some of the wealthiest people in the country actually paid taxes, they would be able to use their voice to stop the money from going into nuclear weapons and into other kinds of military endeavors in one country after another.
How many billions are going to redevelop the nuclear establishment in the United States?
They plan over the next 30 years to spend $1 trillion on the nuclear weapons. And by the way, people have the wrong idea that these are weapons that are a holdover from the Cold War. But let me just describe to you our Ohio-class submarines. We currently have 14 of them. Each of the Ohio-class submarines has the equivalent of 4,000 Hiroshima blasts on it. That means that each of them, each submarine, could destroy an entire continent. The Earth only has 7 continents. We have 14 Ohio-class submarines, and we're in the process of beginning to make 12 new ones. It's important to know that of that submarine fleet, 8 of them were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall. At the moment when we thought the Cold War was over, this military technology was going full force ahead. There was a moment in 2017 that the New York Times sat down and calculated how many of these nuclear weapons would be needed to decimate, that was their word, to decimate the population in 7 countries, and it was China, Russia, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, and North Korea. And then they said, how many of our weapons would be left over after we had done that? And the answer was that 73% of our arsenal would not have been used, even were we to carry out that genocidal act. The other reason that people in the United States need to be looking at this is that not only are nuclear weapons horrifying in terms of the amount of damage they do to humans and all other species, but they're fired by a single person. That is, the nuclear architecture is set up so that the president, acting alone, launches the weapon. And there are close equivalent in the 8 other nuclear states. They have one, or they might have 3, but nothing like what in a democracy or almost any form of sane governance has, which is to make sure that if you ever are going to harm a foreign population, that your legislature and your population see the need to do that. You don't have one person making these decisions. But that's
one person being the President of the United States, ultimately?
Absolutely. And that means right now it's President Trump. And the danger isn't just President Trump. He may be a figure that unnerves us more than others do. But other presidents, too, even if they are very sane people, even the most sane person has moments of irrationality, moments of fear. And we know, looking back over the history of the atomic age, that there have been quite a few times when presidents seriously considered launching a nuclear weapon. It's called first use of nuclear weapons. So not firing a weapon after another country has fired a nuclear weapon at us, but initiating it by firing it first. And
the United States has that policy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It has a presidential first use policy. There are right now pieces of legislation in the Senate and the House trying to undo that. There's something called the Markey-Liu bill, which says that the president cannot launch a nuclear weapon if he doesn't have the authorization of Congress. If the Congress hasn't declared war, as the Constitution requires, that the Congress oversee our entry into war, and if Congress hasn't specifically authorized him to use a nuclear weapon. And there's a new movement called Back from the Brink that has the support of many faith groups, many cities in the United States, that has as its first two provisions trying to undo that, saying what it says is no first use and no arrangements that let the president acting alone launch a nuclear weapon.
Maybe give us some hope.
Well, here's what should give us hope. If the United States people, if the population would insist on it, we can bring about worldwide nuclear disarmament. People sometimes think that it's hard to unmake nuclear weapons. That's not true. It is not hard. It only takes a few hours to dismantle the nuclear triggers. It would then take, months to bring in the nuclear submarines, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, it would take, by the time you stored all the material, it would add up to years. But it's completely doable. It's much easier to solve than, for example, global warming, even though we should all be working hard to undo global warming. It is something that is difficult to see how we can undo it. Nuclear weapons, that's not true. As soon as the population steps forward collectively and insists on it, it can be done. And I'm just hoping that in the coming months, people of the United States will awaken to this problem. Something Gandhi once said, you can wake a man who's asleep, but you can't wake a man who's pretending to be asleep. And it's not clear whether the United States population is asleep or just pretending to be asleep. But in either case, we need all of us to come forward and help undo this.
Elaine Scarry is on the faculty of Harvard. She's a professor of aesthetics and an expert on the problem of nuclear weapons. She's the author of Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. And 3 years into Donald Trump's presidency, the United States government is ramping up its effort to seize private land in Texas to build a border wall. Trump's signature campaign promise has consistently faced political, legal, and environmental obstacles in Texas, which has the largest section of U.S.-Mexico border, most of it without fencing, and much of the land along the Rio Grande, the river that forms a border in Texas, is privately held and environmentally sensitive. Almost no land has been taken so far, but Department of Justice lawyers have filed 3 lawsuits this month seeking to take property from landowners. On Tuesday, lawyers moved to seize land in one case immediately before a scheduled court hearing in February. The agency says it's ready to file many more petitions to take private land in the coming weeks. While progress has lagged, the process of taking land under eminent domain is weighted heavily in the government's favor. And finally, a freight train crossing the Potomac River near Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, derailed early Saturday morning, causing 2 cars to plummet into the water. 7 cars derailed on the bridge. A section of footbridge that's part of the Appalachian Trail was wiped out. Apparently, no one was on the bridge and there were no reported injuries. The CSX company says there were no hazardous materials on the train. Harpers Ferry is a national park, the United States Armory before the Civil War in 1859. It was was the location of an attempted rebellion by radical anti-slavery abolitionists led by John Brown. The raid is often said to be the start of the American Civil War, ending slavery in the United States. That's some of the news for Saturday, December 21st, 2019. The news was engineered by James Irsay. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Up next on WBAI, On Contact with Chris Hedges, coming your way very shortly.